Welcome to Day to Day, our monthly exploration of how we use satellites to monitor the Earth's environment. I'm joined by Dr. Hayley Evers-King. Welcome, Hayley.
Hi, Mark.
Who is our guide to all things ocean.
Yep.
So we were talking just before we started recording about cake.
Yes.
And
I love cake.
Cake is a great concept. And swirls. So tell me about swirls and cake first. Why did you make a swirly cake?
So I have this kind of weird passion, which I've actually had for quite a long time, since I was at school, actually, of making like scientific concepts out of cake, which usually ends up with cake that looks a bit weird and sometimes tastes a bit weird because, you know, the two things are not naturally going together quite so well, you know, bright colours, things like that. But this time we had a meeting here, actually, between different colleagues from different groups in UMetSat. And I wanted to make something that was symbolic of the ocean and something that captured all the different parts of the ocean and how it's observed by satellites that we all work on here. And I chose to make a cake of what we would call an eddy. And as you said, an eddy can also be kind of thought of as an ocean swirl. And it has physical and biological features, which make it really quite a charismatic thing to kind of render in cake form, if you like. So I had different coloured batter to represent different temperatures, and I swirled them into the tray that I was using to bake my cake, and I made it sort of dome in the middle, and I decorated it with different colours of green and blue to show the biological impact, and then I made a little satellite which I stuck on the top to observe the whole thing. So, yeah, I have a bit of a...
Oh, which satellite?
Sentinel 3, of course.
It was Sentinel 3.
That's my satellite, you know. So not explicitly mine, but, you know, the one I work with most of all.
I remember eating the cake, but I've forgotten about the actual satellite and which satellite it was.
Actually, still, the little satellite was made out of sugar, like... modeling kind of sugar that you use for cake. And so it's actually still sat up in my office because, you know, you dry it out, you can keep it for a long time like people do with their, you know, wedding cake toppers and things like that. So I've still got the little sugar kind of modeling paste version of Sentinel 3 up in my office.
That's fantastic. So I love the cake. The cake was fun. But actually, I think I enjoyed the cake and I didn't pay enough attention to the art. So you had a mixture of colours in there. You had a dome. Mm-hmm. So describe for me, if I was to look at an ocean swirl from above, what would I see?
Depends where you're looking from. If you're out on a boat, you probably wouldn't necessarily see an awful lot because of the scale of how big these things are sometimes.
So how big is a swirl? When we're talking about swirls, what sort of scales are we talking about?
Lots of different ones, really, in honesty. But the kind of these eddies, these kind of swirls we're talking about, typically are, you know, in the range of... tens, hundreds of meters up to kilometers, hundreds of kilometers maybe. So they're kind of a middle-sized phenomena in the ocean. Mm-hmm. If we think about the ocean covering all these different scales from the very, very tiny, you know, the microscopic plankton, right up to big ocean currents that cover half the globe, they're kind of right in the middle, usually. So if you're on a boat, you're kind of sat in the middle of one. You might not necessarily see it. But if you look from a satellite, these things are absolutely beautiful. And you can see how these big swirling patterns happen. And, you know, they remind me a lot of things that I first learned about from the kind of meteorological world, which I know is more your background. So, and that for me is interesting because this concept of swirls really brings many different fields in the Earth system together, both the meteorological and the ocean as well, because these things are fluids and they react in similar ways. Sometimes they have different, very different impacts, really. I mean, as we've spoken about hurricanes,
very
different impact to what we have typically from swirls in the ocean, but.
Yeah, so in meteorology, when we think of swirls, we're often talking about rotation and how the energy of rotation is moved around the atmosphere. And that can lead to storms, to tornadoes, to hurricanes. And that's when we get into the stuff that really affects people.
Yeah.
But on yours, you also mentioned this sort of dome. You said your cake had a kind of a dome on it.
Yeah.
So what was that about? Why?
Well, the effects of rotation can cause this doming. I mean, it happens in the big ocean gyres, these big circulations we get, but it also happens in the smaller eddies. And it can be kind of a doming or actually kind of like a sinking.
So what causes that?
That's the rotation itself.
So it's literally just the water is getting piled up, literally.
Yeah, it's this balance between the rotational force, so the Coriolis, if you've heard, you know, you've heard of it, I'm sure, but if our listeners have heard of it as well, this because the Earth rotates, we have this thing called the Coriolis force. And then we have various gravitational forces as well. And when you balance those up, you get this effect on water that it can actually dome. So those big gyres I was talking about in the center of the ocean are actually higher than other parts of the ocean. The ocean is not flat, even though when we look at it, we often think it is, you know, aside the waves and stuff. It actually has these really big kind of like topographical features about it. And eddies have these too.
So if we're looking down, from a satellite, we'd see a swirly pattern, we'd see the rotation. If we had an animation, I guess we might even see it rotating.
Yeah, you would see it in something like the color of the water. Yep. So that would be the effect on the biology. You could also see it in the temperature, which is really a representation of what's going on physically. So the temperature around these features changes because of the way they rotate and how water is being moved up and down throughout the water column. You could also see it from the altimetry data that we get, because that's actually measuring the height.
So that would be, you just see the dome there.
Yeah. So, and the currents, potentially.
So in meteorology, there's a kind of a classic effect where you get some wind, it blows across an island, and then downstream of the island, you get these little swirly cloud features. They're called common vortex streets.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. They're absolutely beautiful. Really are stunning in images.
And so quite often we'll have a look at satellite pictures, particularly, say, of the Tenerife and the islands there, the Gran Canaria Islands, and usually downstream of the wind, there's these clouds, and they're just beautiful. And then we can start to get into the physics of it. Oceanographers, you like swirls? Do you find swirls kind of beautiful? Are there particular places where people go to? What are your go-to places for swirls?
I think we're probably just as fascinated with them as you guys are in the meteorological world, to be honest. And you get them in a very similar ways, like you're saying. You get them out, you know, in the wakes of islands. You can get these eddies, swirls produced from that. But you also get them as a result of currents in different locations, often going along the edges of land masses. So areas like the Gulf Stream, you might see them, the Agulhas Current, these are their western boundary currents, the Karusho.
So where's the Agulhas Current?
The tip of southern Africa.
And Karusho?
Is near Japan, Gulf Stream coming off.
Okay, so these are your kind of your go-to places to
these
start
some
to think, where
ones.
Am I going to see?
Yeah, these are quite big ones you get there, but you also get them in lots of different places, and sometimes we don't quite know why. Our guest today will tell us a little bit more about where we can find them, and she's really good at spotting them, but you get them all over the place, really, depending on how the ocean is moving.
So our guest, so you mentioned our guest, we're going to be talking to Dr. Ida Ascoletti later on, who is working in the University of Liège in Belgium, and who is, this is what she does, she just studies swirls all the time.
She's the queen of swirls.
She is the queen of swirls. And actually, so we both follow her on Twitter, and there is something about her Twitter feed, which it's not just about beautiful pictures, but her storytelling is also there's something about it that's quite special, and I can't quite put my finger on what.
Yeah, I mean, for me, what I really like working with Ada, and I've worked with Ada quite a lot over the last year or so, and because this topic around eddies, swirls, whatever you want to call them, lends itself really well to working with the Copernicus Sentinel 3 data, which is what I'm mostly working with, because it has these multiple instruments that can look at the physical heights from the altimetry, the sea surface temperature from those instruments, and the ocean color as well. This really allows us to kind of pick apart what's happening with these eddies, these swirls. And Ada's been able to pull this together beautifully as part of her research and tell these kind of stories about these individual eddies. And some of them last for longer than others. Some of them pop up and disappear and come back again. Some of them come off currents that we've seen that have been quite stable. These are the sorts of things we've been working on together.
Give me an example of a story. So where might have we have seen a relatively temporary phenomena? And how long did it last for? How big was it? So just to give me a sense of the sizes that we're thinking about.
So this last couple of weeks, Ada and I have actually been looking at some particular swirls, eddies that have been coming off a current off the north coast of Africa, the southern Mediterranean. So this is the Algerian current. And this current is quite unstable. So it kind of goes along the coastline. But every now and then it kind of goes a bit crazy and spins off these swirls, these eddies. And some of those eddies can be up to 100 kilometers in size, and they can last for quite a while.
So how long is quite a while?
up to a couple of years, even.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think they can. Okay. They can persist for quite some time. No, they can persist for quite a lot of time. The ocean tends to be a little bit slower, I think, than the meteorological world. You know, we're a little bit less dramatic, which is a shame in some ways, but it can be a bit like that.
Oh, right. Okay, so you said the current's unstable. Why? What does that mean? How would I see it?
I think you should ask Ada that.
Okay, we'll do that then. We can do that. And so we've talked a little bit about what they look like, how big they are. We haven't yet got into biology and the physics, but we can do that maybe in a moment. But do they matter? Why is the study of these things important?
Yeah, I think they are really quite important, depending on where you're looking and kind of the scales you're looking over. But they have a very important role to play in how currents affect the ocean's behavior as a whole, and how that links with things like our climate. That's one of like the real strong motivations people have had for researching these in the past and at the present as well, is how much does this kind of scale of circulation affect things like our global heat cycling?
Right.
You know, how much of the circulation is in the big currents we see and how much of it is in these kind of smaller, relatively shorter time frame features? They call it the mesoscale, this kind of middle scale. And it's important to figure that out, because if we then want to do something like run a climate model, we have to know how important is it that we represent that scale. Yeah. You know, if we can run a coarse model that's big and global, you know, it doesn't take as much computing power, it's a bit easier to sort of summarize than if we have to try and get every little minute detail of a physical circulation correct in order to represent the whole. You know, we're quite limited with whether we can actually model the entire ocean in that sense. So we have to kind of pick and choose our battles when it comes to that, really.
So this is the, do we understand enough about the ocean so we can work out how much heat,
heat exchange, salt, this is, you know, this big circulation. Eddies play quite a crucial role in that in different parts around the Gulf Stream, the Agulhas, so places like that as well.
So if I've understood, it's not just about moving things sort of around the world, but it's also vertically as well. We're moving stuff from the surface down to the deep ocean or the middle, I don't know, middle deep ocean, whatever that might mean.
And this is where the biological impact really comes into play. So when you're moving stuff between the upper and lower levels of the ocean, often what you're moving, as well as like physically warmer or colder water, which may be a better or worse habitat for certain species, you're usually also moving nutrients. And that's what feeds all the life that goes on in the ocean, you know, from the very basic level of the phytoplankton.
So when we're talking about your Algerian current, the current across Algeria and eddies and swirls there, how much, when we think about the vertical, how much effect is there vertically?
Quite a lot.
So
yeah,
and that's where. So how far is, like, 1 kilometer, 5 kilometers?
Many kilometers. I think you'd have to. I'm not sure. It depends exactly how deep the actual water is itself, as to how and how strong the eddies are, as to how deep.
So it can be the whole depth.
I think it can be. Yeah. I mean, I know that the eddies, for example, I was reading about the ones around Algeria, and they can be steered by the bathymetry. This is what they call it. So where you have the bottoms of the ocean, you know, is obviously not flat in a lot of places. You know, you have canyons, you have domes, you have all these different features, seamounts, everything like that. And I know that eddies can be steered by these. So they must be very deep, obviously.
So this is the same as the cloud effect.
Yeah.
For the clouds, we're living at the bottom of the atmospheric ocean with our mountains, and you see the cloud effect, and you'll just get those similar things spinning around at the bottom of the things like the Mediterranean, the deep ocean as well.
Whereas the ocean, we're at the top, you're trying to look down. So it's, you know, it's a very different perspective, but similar effects physically. You know, the actual physical systems have a lot in common when we're talking about fluid dynamics, whether it's the atmosphere or the ocean.
Yeah. So Hayley and I will quite often, at the beginning of the day, talk about something we have seen on Twitter. And very often, it'll start with, did you see one of Ada's tweets with something swirly? So I'm really quite pleased to introduce Dr. Ada Alvarez-Azcarate from the University of Liège.
Wrong again. It's Ada Alvarez-Azcarate.
I'm going too fast. Dr. Ada Alvarez-Azcarate from the University of Liège in Belgium. Ada, welcome.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Hayley.
So I don't know if you were aware of the fact that we actually talk about your tweets quite a lot at work.
Oh, that's
first
nice.
Of all, thank you for your Twitter timeline, because it is a source of joy. So when we look at your stuff, we quite often see these swirls. What is it that you study and why?
Okay, so I study ocean dynamics in general using satellite data. And these swirls and these eddies and these structures, they add beauty to the scene. I mean, I'm not here just for the beauty of it, but it's true that they really eye-catching. It's like eye candy in these images. So you can see something which is very particular, very different from the surroundings, and that has this very dynamic aspect. You can look how it changes with time. So it's really adding some interest into satellite data, these swirly images. But I like them also quite a lot.
So if somebody's not seen one, could you describe what they might see from, say, one of your favorites from recent times?
So there are different ways of looking at these spheres with different variables. So we can look at natural color images, and then you will see scenes of the ocean in which you can see the blue waters that we are used to look at the ocean. And then you can see some spheres that have trapped water with high turbidity, so sediment that come from maybe from land. And these are like rounded white or brownish waters, which are surrounded by blue ocean water. So this is a way of really looking at these images, like looking at the natural color of the captured by the satellites. But of course, you can also look at some other variables like sea surface temperature, and then you will need to, not using natural colors, but to derive an image and put some colors, some artificial colors to it. And then you will see some water. You put the color you want, but then you will see this sphere, this eddies, as a as a standalone structure by its own. So they are quite eye catching. They really jump at your eyes when you see them.
And you said that, of course, you're not studying them solely for their beauty. What kind of science questions do you have? What are the things that you're actually trying to study by looking at these structures?
Well, I would like to assess what the impact of these structures are in the mean field. So we have currents in the ocean, and these currents tend to have a lot of variability. And this variability, I mean, so a current will not go in a straight line. It will wind, it will meander, and then sometimes you have these swirls and these eddies that will form. So how these eddies will affect the main state of the ocean that we are trying to understand. So what is the net effect of these eddies? Are they happening often? Why are they happening? Why are they forming? How are they dissipating? What are the impacts in the ecosystem? There are a lot of questions that are being addressed in the role of these eddies.
So Hayley was mentioning earlier the Algeria case I think you've been working on together. So just can you describe for me, when you say the effect on the average, can you describe for me what that might mean in terms of, say, the Algeria example? What's known, what you do know, what you don't know, what you're learning?
Okay, so in the Algeria basin, so that's the southern part of the Western Mediterranean, you have water entering into the Mediterranean through the Strait of Gibraltar, and then on average, so that the water travels east to the eastern Mediterranean, but it doesn't travel in a straight line. It travels and it, as I said, it starts winding around. So it will follow the coastline, the Algeria coastline, but it will sometimes deviate from the coast up to the open ocean and then go back to the coast and again, like a winding. And it will add dynamic variability into the system. So when you have a current that is getting out of the coast, you will have a dynamic within the coast, which is different if you have a current that is going into the coast. Mm-hmm. So the mean travel, so if you put a particle, if you put a rubber duck in the Strait of Gibraltar, it will end up going eastwards, but it won't go in a straight line. It will just wander around, circle and travel east, but moving around. I mean, swirling around.
Yeah, and your main interest is actually the dynamics, how stuff moves.
Yes.
I know Hayley's also interested in the biology. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about the the biology of this? Say, take these Algeria example, Hayley.
Yeah, and this is where, I mean, from my perspective, like eddies and swirls, these kind of things, this is where I've usually looked at them from. It's the perspective of kind of either the true color. So either, you know, we've got sediments moving or we've got maybe more green blue waters, which gives me some kind of indication about the biology. So what I really like and what I like about writing these cases with Ada is that we can actually bring those two things together. So Ada, do you want to share your perspective on how the physics then affects the biology?
Yes, well, this is well known, in fact, of water moving, as I said, water moving off of the coast will, so you have this water like getting out of the coast, so you need more water filling the coast. So this water will come from the bottom of the ocean, so from waters that were before under the surface. So this is what we are calling an upwelling. So these waters will go up near the coast, and because they are colder, they are subsurface waters, colder waters, they are typically richer in nutrients. So these nutrients, once they get into the surface, they can help organism grow. It's food for the ecosystem. So you will enrich the ecosystem by this upwelling movement, this movement of water from the subsurface into the surface. So the Algeria current, when you have these meanders, these spheres, when they go offshore, they will create these havens of life. They will create these places where biology can thrive. And in the contrary, as I said, when you have the current going into the coast, then you have maybe warmer waters that are getting into the coast, lower in nutrients, so you won't have as much biological development.
Yeah. So as well as like the physics affecting the kind of mean state, we also have this physics linking with the biology, which then affects our general kind of productivity of the oceans. Mm-hmm. And I know that the eddies and things we've looked at are like one contributor to how much overall, say, primary production, and then how much sort of fisheries and things like that we're getting out of our oceans in these different areas. It's interesting you mentioned upwelling. It's like one of my favorite topics. I did my PhD looking at an upwelling zone. So I know upwelling happens along coasts as a result of wind. And we know, as you've just said, that it happens around eddies. The upwelling around coasts can sometimes lead to these harmful effects, like harmful algal blooms. But I don't think that's so common with eddies. And this kind of it just reminded me of a question one of our colleagues was asking us when we showed her a picture of one of your eddies was, you know, are these things harmful? She asked us that. And I was like, well, you know, not really. She's like, well, it kind of looks like a hurricane. And I know hurricanes can be really, really dangerous. But I guess, like, how would you kind of answer that question? Are eddies a good thing? Are they a bad thing? What would you say?
Oh, okay. They're not bad. Okay. No, they're not bad.
They're good. I know. But I thought it was an interesting perspective.
No. So eddies can turn in two ways. In fact, they can turn clockwisely or anti-clockwisely. So if they turn clockwisely, they will not, they will not upwell water, so they will not upwell nutrients. So they won't really infer a biological response within the eddy. You can have something at the edges of the eddy, where you have a front. I don't know if you have talked about fronts. If you have a front, then you can favor biological development. But within the eddy, if it's turning clockwise, there won't be as much biological activity. And a lot of eddies that we can see, I won't say most, but a lot of eddies are clockwise, in fact. So they are not really thriving in biological activity. Counterclockwise eddies, those are the ones that will pump nutrients from beneath the surface. So those are the ones that could infer some biological response in the ecosystem. Now, on the harmful thing. Sorry, yes.
So the direction, the clockwise, counterclockwise is to do. This is just because it's kind of going the same way as the Earth rotates or against the Earth rotation, so it brings things up or down.
Yes. So you, when you have, you can think of the way you close a jar with a lid. If it goes clockwise, you turn the lid down, so you have this downward movement. If you turn the lid, if you open the lid, you turn it clockwise, you have this upward movement. So it's more or less the same movement that it's inferred in eddies. This downward movement from clockwise rotating eddies an upward movement in anti-clockwise rotating.
And what makes them go clockwise or anti-clockwise? I mean, you said they tend to be more of one than the other. Is it to do with the way the currents work? I guess it's a combination of several factors. But
yeah, well, when you have a current, one of the most known ones, I guess, that people might have seen is this Gulf Stream current. And Gulf Stream currents will start meandering. So you will have eddies that will form to the right of the current, they will form and rotate clockwise. To the left of the current, they will form and rotate anti-clockwise. So it depends on where you have these eddies form with respect to the current.
And so where are you at in your case study now, Hayley, Ada? Where have you...
We actually have just finished it. So,
you finished it?
Yeah, we were just finishing it off yesterday. So we've been looking at the images from lots of different, the actual scenes that we're interested in this time period from lots of different perspectives. So I think originally Ada found some really nice sea surface temperature imagery, and we could see how this current was breaking down and forming these eddies, so becoming unstable. And then we started looking at it from the perspective of the kind of color. So we looked at the chlorophyll and estimates of the sediments, and we had some good discussions about this actually, because it's quite difficult sometimes to tell how much of the color is due to what's suspended in the water from, say, a sediment versus what's biologically, you know, productive activity that's actually growing. So we did some investigations. I looked at the images in a bit of detail for that, and then Ada thought, well, what we can do as well to add some information to this case study is look at the currents. So she got some data from the Copernicus Marine Environmental Monitoring Service and overlaid the currents on this. So you'll be able to see this on the website in the coming weeks.
Very cool. So Ada, what other research are you involved in right now? What are some of the other projects you're involved in at the moment?
Well, the main topic that keeps me busy now is a project in which I work with Sentinel-2 data.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Multisync. It's financed by the Belgian Science Policy. And we're trying to use Sentinel-2 data to assess water quality in the North Sea. So what is the effect of dredging activities and of windmill activities in the water quality? So it's not eddy related, in fact, but it's the Sentinel-2 data are really helping us to really assess how water quality can change with time, and you can really see so many details with the data set. It's really very helpful, very helpful. Mm.
I think that it shows how the various different aspects of the Copernicus program can be used together. Like we can look at multiple satellites, we can look at multiple instruments upon those satellites as well to answer these kind of ocean questions. And that's really one of the strengths, I think, of this program. Mm-hmm. Ada, I had a question for you because I know you've been involved in a lot. Mark and I were talking earlier about kind of big data and analytics. And I know you've been involved a little bit in some machine learning approaches, in what we call kind of gap filling of data. So trying to understand how we can fill gaps where we're missing data. Do you want to speak a little bit about that? I mean, I know one of your kind of favorite projects is DINIOF and all these different techniques you've been using. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so DINIOF, that's one technique that we developed here at the GHCR, at my group, many years ago already. And it's a technique in which you try to infer what is under the clouds, because with some satellite data in the infrared and the visible wavelengths.
Mark loves clouds. We hate them.
I'm a meteorologist. Clouds are my thing.
Oh, you love them too. Okay, yeah. That's all right then.
Yeah. And so you cannot see through them, but, clouds move around. So there is a way of knowing what is going behind by looking at the spatial and temporal coherence of the data. And that's what DINIOF is about. It's trying to extract from the available data the information to infer what would be there when there's a cloud. So that has been my main activity for many, many, many years now. And this is based, it's a statistical approach, and it's based in a principal component analysis, or EOFs, empirical orthogonal functions. Now, recently, we thought that maybe machine learning can help us, because we have so many data that is coming and that is adding, so many satellite data, that we can maybe use a similar approach to infer missing data using a machine learning approach. And that's something we've been working over the last 1-2 years now. It works nicely. We're still developing it, but it's really, so having all these satellite data sets is really very, very helpful for trying to assess these problems like missing data, gaps in satellite data. So I don't know if you want me to tell the details of the technique.
Oh, I've now got a million questions. I've got questions about how it works, about okay. What I think when we talk to people about machine learning or artificial intelligence, many of the people,
at the moment, isn't it's a popular really big avenue. Word, yeah. Lots of stuff going on, and it's quite exciting. But it's trying to match it up with the right applications, I think, is the challenge for us. And maybe this, as you're saying, is one really good avenue for it.
So how do you? So the kind of the most obvious question that springs to me, I think, is the how do you, when you've gap filled your data, how do you know you've done it right?
Well, the validation is the most important part, right? You do some analysis and then you have to find some independent data to validate your approach. So validate the results.
So what do you use?
In situ data, mostly in situ data.
So people in boats and floating buoys and things.
Yes. You can use some other satellite imagery, but they will also be affected by clouds anyway. Yes. So maybe not that useful. But in situ data is the main way of validating the results. Mm.
Do you ever put fake clouds into the satellite data and then see if the machine can remove them?
Yeah. In fact, that's there are two steps in this validation. So the first step is having in our time series, so we always work with long time series of data, right? Yep. So we have this long time series, we select images that are fairly clean, we take clouds from other images and we put them on the clean image. And so when we have the reconstruction, we can know already if it's good or bad in that particular image. So that's the first step. So that's the way of saying, okay, the reconstruction is working nicely, but then you always need to use independent data. That's really the main point. It has to be independent, has to not have been nearby your analysis technique. Otherwise, you are helping the analysis by using data that are within the data set you are analyzing. So, it's a two-step validation. First, you just put some artificial clouds, good point, Mark, and then you did some classical validation.
And I've got also questions. So the stuff you're doing with the windmills. So obviously the windmill sticks out of the water and rotates. What's the effect you're actually studying there? Is it the flow of the water around the windmill's stick or the interaction with the wind field? I'm interested.
In fact, the windmill has this this mast in the sediment, and the North Sea is quite moody. So when you have a current going through the mast, so the field of windmills, your current will be altered after going through the mast. So we will put in suspension sediments that are in the bottom, and you will see a wake of high sediments after the windmill. And because the North Sea is very so the North Sea has a very dynamic tidal field, so tides are really strong, you will see the wake, so these plumes forming after the windmills, these plumes of turbid water going with the tide. So if the tide is going to the east, then you will have the wake to the east, and if the tide is going to the west, then you will have a wake to the west of your windmill. So you will have this wake, this turbid wake, because of the interaction of currents with the mast and the sediments in the water.
Now, that's, I guess, it's scientifically interesting. Is there a policy or does the Belgian government have a particular interest in understanding this for a reason?
You are affecting the environment. In fact, you are changing it. If you have one windmill, then that's okay. I mean, it wouldn't affect a lot. But we are developing. Well, there is a lot of development in offshore wind farms. So you have to know what is the effect in the ecosystem, in the in the water baths that you are putting your windmills in. If your turbidity goes higher than a threshold, then maybe, and it's all the time like this, maybe you have to do some. You have to assess the quality of the water to see how to balance that. for the moment, I mean, there are studies trying to assess that, but I don't think, I mean, they're not posing a threat to the environment, but just they're just altering it. I mean, you put something on the water, you alter the environment, and what is altering here now is the turbidity.
So it's almost a precautionary principle. These things need to be understood. You recognize by building lots of windmills that will change the environment, so let's not just hope it works, let's understand.
Yes, which seems let's quite see how sensible. How that changes.
It's quite a sensible thing to do.
Yeah, I don't study that, but I know they also alter marine life. I mean, the way like marine mammals go around and go feed themselves, etc. So they will alter all the ecosystem. So that's something that needs to be understood to know the consequences.
Yeah.
This is some of my favorite type of work, where we get into this idea of, or you might call it like sort of trade-off analysis, to borrow kind of a term from the more sort of socioeconomic sorts of fields, where we're looking at how does one decision we make, say to build wind farms, impact the environment in one way? And is that good or bad, you know, versus say if we leave that area open for more for fisheries or for conservation? And I think this is a major challenge for us in the kind of ocean science into policy and management world. And I mean, satellite data really can be a great tool in that sense, because we can observe all these different consequences, activities, impacts together, and actually physically look at them together and start doing that trade-off analysis. So I think that sounds like really interesting work, Ada.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And as I said, these data sets are really very helpful in really seeing so many details that you couldn't see with other data sets. So it's really nice.
Yeah, Mark and I were talking earlier about this, the scales of the ocean, and this, it always blows my mind. And I remember learning this when I was first studying oceanography. Like, we have to think from these kind of microscopic scales when we're talking about plankton and microbes and, you know, microplastics, all these different things that there are ocean issues, all the way up to, you know, long-term climate. And the eddies kind of are an interesting one, the swirls, because they fit in this middle, but they can affect both the smaller scale and the larger scale, you know, when you start averaging out to that mean state. And I think, you know, being able to see at those different scales is really one of the strengths of satellites now.
Cool. And as well as being a researcher, you're also a teacher.
Yes. So we have a master in oceanography here at the University of Liège, and I do teach several classes, mainly ocean remote sensing, which is really fun class to give. I also talk about coastal oceanography. That's something we have been developing for the last few years. And the funniest part for me, at least, is we have 2 weeks of field work in Corsica every year. So we go there with the students to make them do hands-on exercises. So that's also really nice.
That's kind of fun. And what do your graduates go on and do when they graduate from your master's? What do they go on and do? What are their next steps?
The people that come here to do the master, they are mixed. They want more. Some of them want to go into research, to academia, or staying in academia. And many of them, they want to look for a job out of academia. So we have them also to make a stay in an enterprise, so that they can really learn what's going on. So they will go to dredging companies in here in Belgium, or aquariums. They can finish in how do you say that? Consultant firms, so firms that are really going to do environmental analysis, etc. So we have a large range of applications that are addressed by our graduates.
I think Hayley and I, sometimes we get quite excited by, in a way, Team Europe. So this sense of what happens when university entities, policy places, places like CMEMS, organizations like us, when the whole system works, it gets really quite good. And I think your master's students, because they go everywhere within the system. So they're quite a nice example of how the whole thing ends up working. So people don't stay in academia. They go to a whole range of places, all of which are super important.
Yes, but going back to kind of that value chain of like the the process. You know, the capturing of the data is where our role is, but downstream you've got people who are ultimately making decisions about industries in, you know, different regional, local, international government sectors. So, I mean, really, oceanography, because it's such an interdisciplinary subject, kind of fits across a lot of that anyway. But then you add in the satellite data and the kind of social and economic relevance of the oceans at the moment, and yeah, we're covering a huge chain of activities and impacts.
And it feels like something that's maybe changed over the last 20 years. So oceanography isn't just a let's study the oceans because we study the oceans. It's got a very practical edge to it, and sort of the impacts, coastal zones, how it affects life, how it affects biology. It's become really quite important.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's kind of why I got into it. I mean, I don't know if you were the same, Ada, but my kind of drive for the oceans was this big thing that has so many connections to what we do on land, even though, you know, we really only interact with them at the coast, you know, directly. They touch so many different aspects of our lives, and that's why I kind of got into it. But it's becoming even more prevalent now that we can actually get a handle knowledge-wise on the intricacies of those processes.
So Ada, just last questions to finish up. Where are you going next in your research? What are some of the big questions that you want to try and tackle next once you've finished your current workload?
So what I would like, well, it all depends on the funding, of course, so I cannot really say exactly what I will be doing in 1 year, but I am most interested in going into finer and finer scales. So we see these areas we've been talking about, like they are up to 100 kilometers diameter. But when you go smaller than that, you still see eddies and swirls also have very fine scales. And so that's what's called the submissive scale. And how is this adding into the system? So how is this important? And how these larger eddies connect with the smaller ones, and the connection of all these scales. Heli, you were talking about this multi-scale thing. So going finer and finer to scale, to smaller scales. That's what I would like to go in the next few years.
And will there be beautiful images?
Sorry?
Will there be beautiful images?
They will be gorgeous images.
Yes. Ada, thank you so much for your time. It's just a joy to speak to you. Please do carry on posting images, because it's a great way to start our day. It's a real source
of
joy.
I'll try.
if people want to follow you on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle?
It's Ada_Alvera.
And people can also follow Hayley.
Yep, I'm at Hayley Evers King.
Thank you both for spending time to talk about swirls.
Thanks, Ada.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Harry.
All right. Did we miss anything?
There is one thing that I wanted to say when we were talking about the if they are good or bad, dismiss these eddies. So they are not good, not bad, but they can pose a threat. And that's something that, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico, you have these really large eddies that shed from the loop current, and they can pose a threat to oil spill oil platforms, or to shipping, etc. So, I mean, they can be harmful if they are powerful. Yeah. And this Gulf of Mexico ones, for example, they are really powerful. And so I wanted to add something about that.
But I think that would be really good to include, because Madalena did ask us this the other day. She's like, are they harmful? And I was like, not really, I guess. I mean,
well, you have to be aware that they are there. Yeah. I mean, they can change the currents, they can change the mean.
Yeah. They kind of play that role. I mean, we were talking about it, I think, on Twitter the other day about how you can, how knowledge of things like the eddies can be really useful in like search and rescue contexts and anything that gets transported. So, you know, they're not necessarily harmful, but I'm not sure I'd necessarily want to be caught up with one if people didn't know about it and I was floating in the sea. So, yeah, they have this big role within the general transport system that's quite vital for us to know about when it comes to things like search and rescue, or, as you say, for damaging platforms and things like that.
Are you going to be doing another case with Ada in the future?
I mean, Ada and I have got lots and lots of ideas of things we want to work on. I mean, she keeps finding these eddies, and then we see them in the imagery, and then they come and they go, and we've got some nice lofty kind of ideas that we're going to look at, like the long-term variability of whether certain eddies in certain areas come and go.
See what comes.
Yeah, and you know, these eddies pop up in certain locations at certain times and are associated with certain events that are going on. So I'm sure there'll be more eddies to be featured on the case studies. We've already got a few on there, but there'll be more to come, I'm sure.
And having spoken to her today, I now realize what it is I like about her Twitter feed. So you get the beauty of the images, but her ability to relate that to the physics of what's going on, but also make it meaningful to relate it to life. I think it's just astounding the way she communicates her work. I find it a joy. So next month, we're going to turn ourselves back to the composition of the atmosphere. So it'll be with Federica Feely. And Hayley, we'll be back together in a couple of months' time to continue our exploration of the oceans. Thank you for your time. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
You're welcome.
And if you want to know more about what UMETSAT does, and particularly what we're doing with the Copernicus satellite data, do have a look at our website, and you can see Hayley's brand new case. Or Hayley
coming
and Ada,
soon, yes.
And you can see Hayley and Ada's brand new case coming soon there. Thank you very much.